Hi, this is Janie Reisner. Thank you for joining me this evening. We are privileged to have Rianne Eisler with us once again, discussing yet another world-tilting book, Sacred Pleasure, Reclaiming Sex, Love, Pleasure, and the Sacred. Gloria Steinem writes, "This is Rianne Eisler's most stunning, far-reaching, and practical gift, both to readers and to a world that must change or perish." Why, when avoiding pain and seeking pleasure are primary human motivations, have we been taught that the pleasures of sex are sinful and bad? Why do we so often find it associated not with erotic love, but with the marketing of women's bodies, or with sadism and masochism, with dominating or being dominated? Sex is one of our most basic human drives. Moreover, sexual relations are more physically intense and more often fully felt than any other personal relations. This is why the way sexual relations are constructed influences all other relations. And how sex and sexual relations are defined is in turn also profoundly influenced by a society's economic, religious, and political structure. Rianne's important book, Sacred Pleasure, contrasts two very different ways of constructing human sexuality within the larger frame of two very different ways of organizing human relations, one relying more on pain, note the dominator model of today's patriarchal world, and the other more on pleasure, the partnership model of 5,000 years ago, where for many thousands of years, much longer than the 30 to 50 centuries we call recorded history, life was peaceful and egalitarian, without war and rape and child abuse, and where for our ancestors both life and pleasure were within the realm of the sacred. It was a time when pleasure was sacralized, particularly that most intense physical pleasure we are given to feel, the pleasure of sexual ecstasy. And where the female vulva was revered as the magical portal of life. Far from being sneeringly called a vulgar word, women's pubic triangle was the sacred manifestation of creative sexual power. And far from being of a lower, base, or carnal order, it was the primary symbol of the powerful figure known in later Western history as the Great Goddess, the divine source of life, pleasure, and love. Take a look around you. Hello, Rianne.
Yes, I heard your lovely introduction.
Oh, good. You have such beautiful words, such comforting words, that describe a life and time that we are trying so hard to reawaken into consciousness. And yet, at the same time, you pull away the veil of taboo and expose not only the horrific abuse by patriarchal men upon women and children and other men, but the whys and hows of that abuse.
Well, I want to say that I always find that when we do a show together, Janie, you and I, that it's a very special experience for me because you have such a deep, deep understanding of my work and, yes, of a partnership way of looking at the sacred, which, of course, you also express in your lovely music.
Thank you.
So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such an important subject.
Yes, it is. And I think that for me, the importance is not only that it's so fascinating to rediscover clues to a more partnership-oriented way of culturally constructing both sexuality and spirituality, but most important is what it tells us about so much of what is happening today, about the attempt to, as you say, to reawaken this, about the new consciousness of the importance of the feminine as part of the sacred, of the importance of a spirituality that is both immanent and transcendent, so that everything in our life can really be animated by that awe and that wonder and that pleasure. And you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about, it's so interesting, there was a time when there was a great deal of contempt for what was called animism, which was this earlier notion that all of nature and all of life is inhabited by spirits, is spiritual. And yet, look at the so-called conquest of nature. That would never be possible, would it? The destruction that we're seeing, if we had really continued in a partnership direction instead of, well, what we're now trying to reverse, you know, this shift that happened in prehistory to what I call the dominator or domination model.
You point out so clearly how this dominator model has worked and how it perpetuates its existence. You write that societies orienting primarily to the dominator model, which have historically ranked men over women, kings over subjects, and man over nature, have built in and into their basic social structure a number of devices that distort and repress our natural bent toward love and sexuality. And one which most of us are all too painfully familiar is the vilification of sex and women.
Well, that is, of course, a device that we're trying to get, you know, to leave behind. And some of what indeed happened during the so-called sexual revolution of the 60s was really the rejection of this notion that this most natural human activity, sexual bonding, sexual pleasure, is somehow tainted with sin, with evil. St. Augustine, a man who, as somebody said to me, must have had a lot of trouble with his mother, because he was so anti-woman, had this really pathological notion that it is through sex that what he called original sin, you know, our this sort of original disobedience, as he saw it, is passed on from generation to generation, which is really a very weird idea, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That the act that gives pleasure and the act that gives life dooms us to live in misery. There's so many strange things in the dominator model. And one thing I want to emphasize, which is, it's not only that it is very, very much of a, well, it's been a very brutal system towards women, and we still see that in parts of the world that orient more to the domination model than we do in the West. But it's also been really rotten for men when you come right down to it. Sure, they have more privilege in the system, but only in relation to those below them, of course, women, children, so-called inferior races or religions. But they, in terms of that whole ranking system, I mean, men have a very, very hard time in that model. And for millennia, they've been required to give their lives, their bodies, just because some guy on top wanted more real estate. Mm-hmm. And it's a very tense way of relating.
Of course,
because even those on top are always having to worry about somebody coming to displace them, right?
Right.
Because
right.
The only two alternatives in that model are you either dominate or you're dominated. Right. So you've got war of the sexes built into the actual fabric of the society. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, as long as people don't understand that there is the partnership alternative, naturally they're going to vie for control, for dominance, because who wants to be on the bottom?
Piece of that that you bring out that I think is very important is this: the second way in which this occurs is the eroticism of domination and violence by dominators.
As I point out, there are a number of ways that you can construct sexuality in ways that really interfere with that natural bond of pleasure. You know, society is orienting more to the partnership model. They're not completely violence-free. They're not completely ideal. But violence, domination, they aren't part of the social fabric. They aren't idealized. They aren't institutionalized. So one way that you mentioned of distorting sexuality is the vilification of sex and woman. And we certainly have that a lot in our Christian heritage. It's very interesting, though, because the vilification of woman, there are Buddhist traditions of that, where Buddhist monks can't even touch a woman. You know, she's supposed to be so polluting. Same idea, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. So I make that point because it's very, very important that we not think that the solution to all of this is to flee east, right?
That's correct.
Because,
that's absolutely correct.
I mean, that is very, very embedded there, too. But as you say, the second way, or a second way, of distorting sexuality is eroticizing domination and violence. And we, in this time of regression to the domination model, because, you know, we've moved forward a great deal, but there's this backlash and this regression. So it's, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And all these images in the mass media, not just in pornography, but even in advertising, MTV, you know, those videos that kids see, the music videos, it's this linking of sex with domination and violence, with sadism and masochism, yes, with dominating and being dominated. It is so very pernicious, because what happens then is that it's like the Pavlov dogs. People become aroused sexually by this constant association, not just by sex, but by violence and domination.
Yes, absolutely.
And we really have to be aware of what's going on.
That's very important. I'm speaking with Rhianne Eisler, talking about her book, Sacred Pleasure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Women's Voices. Your book is divided into two parts. In part one, how did we get here? You contrast contemporary sexual images, along with the brutal practices they reflect, with ancient erotic images. And as we begin to look, we see the sometimes amazing and obvious clues to an earlier and very different spirituality, sexuality, and society.
Well, it's so interesting. Again, in the 19th century, when the first excavations, really, of archaeology, with not just looking for treasures, the big things for museums and the gold, but to try to understand what kind of cultural, what kind of social organization did this earlier art reflect? And of course, what happened then, and it's happening again today, is trying to fit these earlier images into, projecting onto them, if you will, the domination model. So the many so-called Venus figurines, they were seen as part of sort of an obscene thing, you know, pornography, strange pornography, because after all, they're huge. They're very huge hip. Many of them look pregnant. And the same thing in Stone Age art, in, 30,000-year-old art, of the many vulvas and phalluses, which were obviously had to do something with an understanding that sex is the, it gives us life. And it was part of a belief system of sex, birth, death, and then rebirth, because we see that also in, for example, the cowrie shells, they're vulva-shaped. and as well as the red ochre, you know, the menstrual blood symbolism that you see in the burials. And this is, you know, I mean, it's like a language, if you will, but it can be so misunderstood. And again, in this time of regression, there's a huge effort by some scholars, and it's not deliberate, it's really an ideological thing to say, well, I mean, you can't really say these are vulvas. We're going to call them ovals with clefts. But, of course, they still call phalluses phalluses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and then they claim that some of these Venus figurines, which are really goddess figurines, I mean, they have some kind of spiritual, ritual significance, that they were just dolls. And, I mean, it's ludicrous because, I mean, here you, for example, there's the Venus of La Salle. She's, first of all, not portable. She's carved at the entrance of a cave sanctuary. And in one hand, she has a crescent moon with 13 notches. Those 13 notches are not only the lunar cycles, they're also women's menstrual cycles. And with the other hand, she points to a very clearly etched vulva. So clearly this had some kind of mythical significance, some kind of ritual significance. But people like to sort of deny all of this, negate all of this. And then, of course, when you move on to, you know, 10,000 years ago to the so-called Neolithic, again, you see birthing figures. It was so fascinating to me when I was doing the research for Sacred Pleasure. I mean, it just hit me how many of our sacred images are either associated with the suffering or inflicting of pain. And not only Western images, you know, the saints and Jesus on the cross, but the Mahabharata, you know, all of these gods killing each other, hurting each other. And here is a figure celebrating not the taking of life, but the giving of life. And then also all of these carvings of anticipating what we call the sacred marriage, the sacred union between goddess and god as the vivifying force. And it is, we really need to be aware of this, and we need to help people see our past from a different perspective, because if we keep having this notion, well, like the caveman cartoon, right? I mean, here he is with one hand, he's dragging a woman by the hair, and with the other one, he's got a club, you know? So what does it tell kids before their brains are fully formed? And they have no critical faculties yet, that, you know, male violence, male dominance, that's just how it is and how it always was. And it's not true.
Yes, yes. And when we contrast all of that with the pornography of today, and you write, it's most explicit in expressing how our society views female and male bodies, both in nudity and its depiction of the elsewhere taboo act of coitus. And it also most explicitly expresses culture, beliefs, and practices in which sex is more like making war than making love. For here we see women, sometimes little girls or little boys, as merely male sexual objects. We find women and children in chains, women being humiliated, degraded, beaten, tortured, and even killed. Although this is something most of us would rather not come face to face with, all of this does not just happen on the pages of a magazine or video cassette. It happens all too often in real life. And you mention about the infamous snuff films, and we've heard about it in the news, the young women being murdered along the U.S.-Mexican border, having been photographed as they were tortured and killed for the snuff films, the multi-million dollar pornography and sex industry.
Well, it reflects a very pathological way of looking not only at sexuality, but at humanity. And it dehumanizes men, not only women, to really keep associating sex, as I said, the act that gives pleasure and gives life, with domination, and yes, even with killing. Now, some people think that this is modernity, right? But the truth of the matter is, and this was, again, when I was doing the research for Sacred Pleasure, it just hit me, you know. If you look at some of the art of the Middle Ages, at when, you know, women were being tortured as so-called witches, you see almost the same images of men sexually torturing women. And I give some examples in Sacred Pleasure. So this does not reflect modernity. It reflects a regression to the domination model. And if we're aware of this, because, you know, the temptation of people is, well, you see, it was even there then, it must be human nature. But it's not human nature. And I put together sometimes for presentations on Sacred Pleasure a slideshow showing very different images of eroticism versus pornography, because I do make that distinction between erotica, which is, the problem isn't nudity. The problem isn't sexuality. The problem is what we've been talking about, the debasement of one human being by another, that even the torture of one human being by another, and that linking of that with sex, that is not natural, it's not human nature, but it is built into the domination model. Mm-hmm. At the same time that, you know, sex and women were vilified, it was obvious that these carvings and these paintings, I mean, they were commissioned by the men who were in real life torturing, sadistically torturing women in that way, by the inquisitors,
yes,
of the church.
Amazing, isn't it?
Well, if we understand history from the perspective of the tension, not between religious and secular or right versus left and so on, but the tension between the partnership model and the dominator or domination model as two underlying possibilities for structuring beliefs, institutions, and relations, then we can really understand what's going on. And both are possibilities. Unfortunately, I mean, one is not only very painful and makes for a lot of misery, but at this point of our technological development, you know, the mix of high technology, of nuclear weapons, of biological weapons, of the once hallowed conquest of nature, and the mix of all of that with high technology, it's a potentially lethal mix. At the same time that we are in unprecedented crisis, it also is an unprecedented opportunity because, well, I mean, it is the human survival instinct, really, that is, to some very real extent, behind what's happening, which is a lot of movement towards partnership, countered, as I said, by enormous resistance and, yes, periodic regressions. And we're in one of those regressions now.
Well, we certainly are, and we need to move out of it. As Gloria Steinem said on the cover of your book, we must change or perish. You know, I think also about we hear a lot about satanic cults who kidnap children to torture in their rituals, and that these cults often seem to spring up in areas where there are military bases, which makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense. It also makes sense that they seem to spring out in areas where there is so-called fundamentalist religion.
It's been thought that the two boys who did the shooting at Columbine had been subjected to satanic rape abuse.
Well, it is possible. I mean, the thing is this. We know, of course, that abuse of women, abuse of children, in other words, intimate violence, is really something that we have to address if there's going to be any realistic possibility of a less violent, more peaceful world. And that is why I want to invite listeners to join us in the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence. And for those who are interested, they can go on. It's a project of the Center for Partnership Studies, but it's also a project of other organizations. In fact, a CD-ROM with materials on SAVE can be obtained. They can find out about it on the website. It's partnershipway.org, and go on the left side to Spiritual Alliance to stop intimate violence. And, you know, change doesn't happen by itself. It happens because dedicated women working with men. This is not women against men or men against women. It's really both women and men working to move towards that more equitable, peaceful, and sustainable future that we so want and need.
Yes. Contrasting how life is today, I wanted to read a little bit about your writing about the hymn to Inanna. Mm-hmm. And Dumuzi, the pastoral king god that came from the Sumerian tablets, about 3200 B.C.
They're really our first written records.
Yeah,
and it's fascinating how these two get ignored and the continuity between them and, you know, the images of the sacred marriage already 10,000 years ago in the Neolithic, and the images I described in the Stone Age. I mean, this is a continuity mm-hmm. of belief systems. And yet, it's not what's being taught, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. I wanted to read just a little bit. She, at first, Inanna resists marrying Dumuzi, but then they fall in love. But rather than playing the familiar part of the shy and sexually innocent bride we have been taught to value as the virtuous female, Inanna joyously, indeed boisterously, anticipates their union in language that could be not more overtly sexual. "My vulva, the horn, the boat of heaven, is full of eagerness like the young moon," she announces, before she asks Dumuzi a blunt sexual question laden with agricultural symbolism. "Who will plow my vulva? Who will plow my high field? Who will plow my wet ground?" "Great lady," Dumuzi answers, "the king will plow your vulva. I, Dumuzi, the king, will plow your vulva." Isn't it wonderful?
It's so interesting because she doesn't want to marry him. She wants to marry a farmer mm-hmm. instead of a herdsman. And, of course, one of the clues to the shift is that at least in some world regions in the West, the shift from the partnership to dominator direction. As I said, you know, we're talking about direction. We're talking about, not an ideal society, but a society structured differently. It seems to have been really brought about by hordes of pastoralists, of nomadic herders, who came in and brought with them from more arid regions, where, if you will, the earth was not a good mother, their dominator gods of war, as well as their dominator ways of life. But the thing that's so fascinating is, of course, even then, the kings had to legitimize their rule still through the sacred marriage with the goddess, with Inanna, with Ishtar. In other words, the old traditions had to be co-opted, really. This is already a transitional time because certainly Sumer and then also Babylon were already moving very much in a dominator direction. But the old traditions lasted. And it's so interesting because if you remember, I also described the Gilgamesh epic. And there you have clues again. In the Gilgamesh epic, Gilgamesh actually rejects Ishtar. He says, "I don't need to marry you, you know, I don't need to." So at that point, the shift has been complete. Mm-hmm. He no longer needed the legitimization of the goddess. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. I'm going to break in and say that you're listening to Women's Voices on KZYX. I'm Janie Reisner here with my guest, Rhianne Eisler. I wanted to complete that wonderful story of Inanna, reading again from your work, that it was sobering to reflect that our sacred images, focusing on so much pain, suffering, and death, might have seemed strange, even sacrilegious, to our Paleolithic and Neolithic ancestors. It is even more sobering to reflect on what these people would have thought of our pornography. For to people who saw sex as a sacramental act of communication with nature and with one another, Our sexual images of men humiliating, degrading, mutilating, enslaving, and even killing women in the name of sexual pleasure would have been totally incomprehensible and patently insane. And they would have wondered, as so many of us do today, how such perverse notions could have taken hold, a question we will pursue as we proceed on our journey of rediscovery to still more deeply probe the sexual cultural history of Western civilization. All of this in your book and Sacred Pleasure and More.
Well, I like the way that you read from the book, and you pick passages so that the listener gets a sense of story, which of course is what I have done. It's a story that continues then with the remissing. You know, I have a chapter, as you know, called The Sacred Marriage in the Dominator World.
Yes.
And that was fascinating for me. I mean, really looking even at the Theseus and the Minotaur legend, and not to speak, of course, then at the so-called mystical marriage of Christianity, where the female part has been written out, where it's suddenly just this marriage between a male god and, yeah, his male priests, in a religion, of course, that is so homophobic, ironically, on top of all of that.
Yes. Let's give your website again. It's www.partnershipway.org, and you also have a post office box, 51936 Pacific Grove, 93950.
Yeah, that's right. Pacific Grove, California.
Right, right.
93950, right. For those of you who don't know where Pacific Grove is.
Right. I also want to give a couple of other websites. My own website is www.janiereisner.com.
You know, there's a wonderful book written by a man called Brian Griffith, who really, it's called the Garden of Their Dreams. And as I do in Sacred Pleasure, he shows really how desertification, aridity, is a way that the domination model often springs out. I'm not an environmental determinist, though, but there's no question that from the work of anthropologist Peggy Sandi, and others, that yes, dominator cultures tend to originate more in arid environments. But the problem is that once that takes hold, cultures, well, they're like living organisms that seek to maintain themselves. So even when they're transplanted into the more fertile areas, those patterns continue. So, for example, there are, of course, we know that, don't we?
Well,
globally.
And
one thing that's so interesting is that when my book, The Chalice and the Blade, was first translated into Chinese, and Sacred Pleasure, by the way, is coming out in Chinese, too, actually this year. But when Chalice was first translated into Chinese, a group of scholars at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences got together to test my cultural transformation theory in China. And they wrote a book called The Chalice and the Blade in Chinese Culture, which is available from the Center for Partnership Studies in both English and Chinese, basically confirming that there, too, there was this shift from an earlier, more partnership-oriented direction. So that seems to have been the case in all the major early centers of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
It makes perfect sense.
Because, I mean, really, if there's one thing that we humans want, it's pleasure, not pain.
Absolutely. You say the wonder is not that there are so many problems from all that we have been suffering under this dominator model, so many personal and social tragedies, that we so often form dysfunctional relationships and cause ourselves and others so much pain. It is a wonder that we have functioned at all, that even staggering under this load, we have still managed to love one another is a tribute to the human capacity and tenacity for seeking pleasure rather than pain, caring rather than conquest, and above all, connection with one another and with all that is creating and loving in ourselves and in our world.
And that really is our gift. I mean, by the grace of evolution, we receive, and this is true for both men and women, we receive neurochemical rewards of pleasure, not only when we are loved, but when we love another. And we've all experienced this.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it's for a lover or for a child or for a friend or for a pet. And the point of it is that I, in another one of my books, as you know, in Tomorrow's Children, which is my book on education, I, among other things, advocate teaching what I call meaningful evolution that doesn't just focus as so much of current popular as well as academic literature does on those, you know, violence, domination, on those qualities that maintain the domination model, but that also take into account that other side of our human possibilities, including what I just said, you know, that, I mean, caring, love, that's part of the human emergence. We humans would not survive if it weren't for our capacity to care.
Right.
And that needs to be emphasized. And by the way, that book, Tomorrow's Children, was just translated into Urdu by a Muslim publishing house in Pakistan. And that book too, Tomorrow's Children, my book on education, is in the process of being translated into Chinese. So the fact that there is this hunger worldwide for this material, for these books, that too is a sign of changes of consciousness, isn't it?
It is. May it spread widely and fast.
Well, that's one of the things I would like to do, and we spoke about it offline. I really would like to do some videos, some films on this. And I hope that there will be people who will want to come forward to help make this happen. I just want to put that intention out into the universe. I want to make a documentary series on cultures of peace, not only from our past, but from our present, because there are some. This is perhaps not the time to go into them. We can do it in another program. And also all the movement towards partnership that we're seeing worldwide, so that, again, we can focus on being proactive to strengthen the partnership movement rather than just being reactive, trying to put our finger in the dam to stop the avalanche of dominator regression. Because that is not enough. We have to move forward proactively.
Yes, we do. And in conjunction with that, I want to say if anyone would like to contact me with that, with some ideas, please do. I've given my website, janiereisner.com. I'll give my telephone number. That's 962-9277. Speaking about the chemistry of love, you mentioned psychiatrist Michael Leibowitz in about the reward of chemicals in our system, and also explains the euphoric bliss that mystics throughout the ages have associated with love for the divine. And it helps us understand what lies behind the intense pleasure we feel in moments of creation, discovery, aesthetic contemplation, and helpfulness to others. This new line of inquiry indicates that the evolution of human love and the evolution of human sexuality are much larger movements. From the primacy of the punishment of pain to the primacy of the pleasure of love. This shift from dominator to partnership model would seem to be animated by nothing less than the push of evolution, not just because the requirements for maintaining human life and the requirements for maintaining a dominator form of social organization are on a direct collision course. It is because in any age, the partnership model, which promotes rather than impedes both love and pleasure, appears to be more congruent with the movement to what we call more highly evolved.
My last book, The Power of Partnership, which was just published in paper this year, it's called The Power of Partnership, really is a handbook for both personal and cultural transformation. And it is precisely because, we live in a world that consists of both, you know, the movement towards partnership, not only in consciousness, but so many people who really are experiencing partnership sexuality and spirituality and finding, of course, that's what we yearn for, that's what we want. But also those, including the millions and millions of little girls and sometimes also little boys who are still in the global sex business, sex trade, who are being, many of them, kidnapped, many of them sold by their own families. It is horrendous the way that this is happening. Then, of course, there is also the, I think, very immoral opposition to sex education. In Sacred Pleasure, I really deal with the immorality of that and the need, the urgent need for sex education, but sex education that doesn't just explain the nuts and bolts of sexuality, but how to protect yourself. And also, I talk about an ethic for intimate relations. Well, of course, in the domination system, there is no such ethic. You know, that's why we've been taught, you know, all fear in war and love, which is crazy. I mean, you know, the war of the sexes, right? So I think, yes, you're very right that we do need practical resources. And both Sacred Pleasure as well as my new book, The Power of Partnership, offers some of those. But it can't just be done on our individual personal level. If we really want to make the world such that little girls and boys won't be sold into the sex trade, where people won't be brutalized, where there won't be, opposition to condoms to prevent AIDS, and all of that irrationality and yet really immorality in the name of morality that goes on, we have to work on the larger shift from domination to partnership, and that's really what my work is about.
Yes. Thank you. Talking a little bit about, which is a wonderful title for your chapter, Waking from the Dominator Trance. For much of recorded history, the absolute, often life and death authority of the male head of household over women and children was taken for granted. Ample data showing that violence and perversion were not just symptomatic of an occasional individual pathology, but of a social pathology. Some historians paint a picture of almost unrelieved darkness, almost total parental indifference to children's suffering. We find that in both Judeo-Christian and classical Greek records of little girls sold or given away in marriage, parents selling their little girls into a concubinage or prostitution, and the socially accepted ancient Greek pederasty, the homosexual coupling of young boys and grown men. And I found this chilling. It was found in a survey of 19th century medical literature that doctors often reported finding venereal disease on the genitals, anuses, and mouths of little girls and boys when their parents had the disease. So we know what their fathers were doing with them.
What we're dealing with are cultural patterns that have been perpetuated and passed on from generation to generation unconsciously, because people who are abused, we know, tend to be abusers, and that in turn maintains the domination model, because these people also, not everyone by any means, but many people then see that model as the only real possibility, whether it's in education, whether it's in religion, whether it's in politics or economics. So one of the things that is so important, the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence, we're trying to get religious leaders to break their silence on violence against women and children, and some men too. including, of course, sexual violence, incest, rape. The fact that we have to ask this, of course, shows you how sad it is, really. I mean, they should have spoken up against it a long, long ago. But one of the ways that we know that you can get to people to awaken, unfortunately, we still live in a culture where anything connected with women or children is considered secondary. So one of the things we're doing through the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence, which also makes us unique, is showing the link between intimate violence and intranational and international violence, again, as a way, well, you know, if you want to get to people, you have to get to them to what they're interested in. And hopefully this will then bring much, much more awareness. You know, yes, waking up from the dominator trance, not only among religious leadership, but among people worldwide. Because, you know, if we could just get more religious leaders to speak up against it, they have moral authority, don't they? Mm-hmm. And we need to engage them. So these are very practical macro interventions that have a cascade of systemic effects. And that's what I'm so interested in my work. What are the leverage points? And this is certainly one of them.
Yes. You write, there's a new breed of historians focusing on the history of the family and sex. And you say the prehistoric shift from partnership to a dominator direction entailed a fundamental restructuring of the family. And this is integral to an understanding of how a repressive and anti-human system has maintained itself, and most importantly, how it can be changed. If we are to succeed in our efforts to reverse that shift, we need a much clearer understanding of how the social construction of family and other intimate relations is a major factor in how all social relations are constructed. And you write, a major reason for this relates that it perpetuates to the psychological mechanism of denial, the suppression out of fear into the unconscious of authentic human needs, perceptions, and experiences, which makes possible the acceptance and even idealization of abusive and violent relations by both the dominated and the dominators. As the psychologist Joe Bernhold points out, what happens to the psyche of an abused child is similar to what happens in a hypnotic state.
Yeah, well, that's why I called it waking up from the dominator trance. We're really not dealing with bad people. We're dealing with a pathological system. And, of course, what we have to change then are the beliefs, the institutions, and yes, very, very, very urgently, the child care practices, giving real education for partnership child care, and also, of course, this whole notion of how sexuality can be constructed. I mean, Masters and Johnson write of a pleasure bond. Well, that pleasure bond, of course, if you don't distort it, would really push us, wouldn't it, toward more of a partnership rather than dominator way of structuring not only the relations between men and women or between, you know, those who have a different sexual orientation between men and men and women and women, but towards a whole social system that is based more on pleasure, on caring. And that's, of course, what we need to be proactive about. So I urge people, when they read my books, really, you can do a lot just in one-to-one. You can also form study groups.
Rianne, I want to thank you very much for being here this evening.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Janie. I just hope that people can use this not only to transform their own lives, but to help transform that web of relations all around us.
Yes.
Because that's what we have to do if we really want to move forward.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
You and me. and aching and dying, and they are me.